Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast with me, David Taylor, magazine editor, and Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news service. It's Wednesday, the 7th of July, and Phil, someone told me just now that football's coming home tonight, which sounds like code for something. Have you any idea what they were talking about?
David, there's a football match on tonight, England against Denmark, to see who goes through to play Italy in the final of the European Championship on Sunday evening. So not one for you, but the rest of us, I think, will be glued tonight.
All right then. Well, we're not going to talk about football today, of course. We're going to talk about a rather important document that's just been published, aren't we?
It's the bill, the Building Safety Bill, which is the long piece of legislation or will be legislation once it goes through all the parliamentary process and the Queen's put a stamp on it, which implements an awful lot of the recommendations of the Hackett Review into the learnings from the Grenfell Tower fire. Have you read it?
I've read bits of it. It's very, very long. And I have to say, and I must confess, that I did start reading it, but found that I could only read it in snatches of about 5 minutes before my eyes glazed over. It's very, very detailed.
Well, what I would say to people is don't even try and read the bill, but you will find online, where you find the bill, explanation notes, which is still a 257-page
I was going to say,
document.
even that, yeah.
But that leaves out all the wherefores and whyfores and forthwith and whatever in the parliamentary language and broadly explains in understandable language the full detail of what's in there.
Yeah. I mean, we did know more or less what it was going to say, didn't we? Because there was wasn't there a draft bill published last year?
Yes.
First draft.
I actually thought, I think everyone did, we're actually going to have the bill starting its passage last year because it was the October 2019 Queen's speech when they announced that they were going to bring forward the bill.
Yeah.
But of course, things got in the way, mainly a global pandemic, which kind of stymied parliamentary business. So we had a draft bill a year ago and people had a chance to run the rule over this. I could not tell you what the difference is. I've asked the question, haven't had the answer. What the difference is between what's been published this week and what was published last year.
Mm.
Oh, I do know one difference. The leaseholders have now got 15 years instead of six years to take legal action against developers who have fallen short. This is meant to be a goodie package for the collateral victims, I suppose you could call them, the collateral victims of the Grenfell Tower fire.
Yeah.
The people who, it emerged in the wake of the fire, were also living in potentially lethal buildings through no fault of their own. And it's interesting to note, I mean, I think we should go on and talk about what's in the bill in a minute, but there are two aspects to it, essentially. One is sort of looking backwards, trying to fix the problems that the, what we might call the consumers, the leaseholders, civilians, have had to put up with in the wake of Grenfell Tower lessons. And the other, is looking forwards, is the changes to the construction industry and architects and contractors and product manufacturers and so on.
Yeah.
But on the sort of the retroactive aspect of the leaseholders, it's not had a great reception, this bill. Essentially, some things are thrown in the way of leaseholders, but people are still going to be stuck with bills that they can't afford to put right problems which
weren't responsible for. Yeah,
exactly. The brouhaha over that will continue as this bill goes through the committee stages and it's poured over. A lot of MPs will say this is just simply not good enough. It doesn't do enough to fix the problems which the construction industry, let's face it, and developers have dumped on leaseholders.
It's not just, I mean, that's one thing, that the leaseholders, and that all comes under the new scheme for the new Homes Ombudsman, doesn't it? But there's far more to this bill than just that. And it's not just leaseholders. We're talking about residents and building safety for people who live and work in these buildings. There's a phrase which is sort of underpinning the whole thing, it seems to me, and that's the use of the term higher risk buildings, which is actually, it is defined in it's certainly in the explanatory notes, it's defined buildings of at least 18 metres height and seven stories, 18 metres or seven stories, which I think we already knew anyway.
But it's also residential.
Yes.
Certainly a lot of this is about the residential buildings, not about office buildings. You talk about buildings people work in. Tower blocks, basically. Residential tower blocks we're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, not just leaseholders, but also tenants, people renting homes as well are affected by this, aren't they?
Yes. Although, if you're a tenant, you're not going to get lumbered with the bill. It's the leaseholders. If you buy a flat in a high-rise block, as you know, you don't get the freehold because it's shared. I mean, it could be shared amongst all the tenants and some
owned by a third party. Yeah,
but more often than not, it's owned by a third party,
who
often is some sort of strange shell company in a foreign registered land who they're invisible and you don't know who they are. You can't put a face on them.
Well, that's a slightly different issue, isn't it? I mean, in fact, there was something, I think only last week, the government was talking about making changes to require house builders to compensate customers who had bought houses or bought leases on new houses and were then finding that their freehold payments to the freeholder were going up almost exponentially year on year. So that's being addressed from a different angle as well, isn't it?
Yes, that's a separate thing. But I think when it comes to this bill, there seems to be fairly broad agreement that leaseholders still get the fuzzy end of the stick in this on this one. You know, as I say, there are sops thrown in their direction, like the extension from 6 years to 15 years for take legal action. But not many people can afford to take legal action against the developer. I mean, it's all slightly inadequate, basically. But let's move on and talk about the other things which we've talked about in the past, which are more of direct day-to-day interest to the construction industry, to architects, contractors, engineers, and so on, which are the new regime that is being created by this bill. We've got the Building Safety Regulator, which is basically the Health and Safety Executive. Chief Inspector of Buildings is the Building Safety Regulator, but it's giving the Health and Safety Executive new responsibility for building safety. And I'm quoting from the explanatory notes here. The Building Safety Regulator has got three core functions. Implementing the new, more stringent regulatory regime for higher risk buildings. In other words, only for these 18 metre plus residential buildings. Overseeing the safety and performance of all buildings. In other words, building control. Overseeing the performance of the building control sector. Understanding and advising on existing and emerging building standards. And the third part of what the Building Safety Regulator is going to be doing, assisting and encouraging competence among the built environment industry and registered building inspectors.
One of the things I found rather surprising about this was how much of what it seems to be proposing I sort of assumed was already in place. Like, for example, it's going to introduce a requirement. Now, let me see if I can find out. Yeah, a requirement that those involved in the commissioning, the design, construction, and refurbishment process will have formal responsibilities for compliance with building regulations. I found that a bit surprising because I thought, what's the point of having regulations of any sort if there's not an assumed responsibility that you have to conform with them? I mean, if you're building a building and building regulations apply, then surely you comply with them, because if you don't, you're breaking the regs. So it seemed to me as if maybe this was a a loophole that they're trying to plug. But there are other things as well. Like, for example, they're saying on higher risk buildings that contractors will no longer be allowed to appoint their own building control body. I frankly didn't know that they could. I assumed that it was... I know that they're... You know, there are private bodies now which can do, you know, sort of building control enforcement and that kind of thing. But I think it's still usually local authority building control that comes along and inspects the work and signs it off at the end of the day. I didn't know that contractors could appoint their own. So it's probably good that they closed that loophole as well. But it did surprise me that I thought that a lot of the things which... And none of these things I disapprove of, none of these measures that they're proposing, I think... are wrong. I'm just surprised that they weren't already in place.
Well, there are similarities with a lot of the detail of this bill. It seems to me the similarities of what we've seen with other narrower bits of legislation, like LOLA, the lifting operations, lifting equipment regulations, which introduced the concept of an appointed person. So there's an individual, you know, you're in charge, Gov, so that there's no buck shifting between the various parties involved, and a broader legislation to the CDM regs, construction design and management regulations, in their various iterations over the years. They've also got the introduced the concept of, right, you know, this has got your name on it, you're the responsible body here. And a lot of what the Building Safety Bill, it seems to me, is all about is trying to narrow down who is responsible. And when a building is finished, there will be a person who is, I don't know if it's an individual person or whether it can be a corporate entity, but effectively there will be someone who will be responsible for the safety, the ongoing safety, and, you know, maintaining fire safety of a building, making sure that the fire doors work and so on and so, and the alarms work and so on and so forth. And so it's clarifying existing. I mean, there is already legislation that says, yeah, you know, certain buildings have to have these certain safety standards, but I don't think what is new here is the concept of apportioning responsibility directly onto someone so that it gets done and doesn't get, you know, the buck doesn't get passed.
One of the fundamental issues that, of course, this all stems from the Grenfell fire. One of the fundamental issues which was raised by Grenfell, of course, was the marketing and specification of products, and that's addressed quite extensively in the bill. And I think you're absolutely right. This is exactly what they've done here. They've clarified the lines of responsibility, who's responsible for what, and what you can and can't do. And one of the big problems, of course, one of the scandals which has been brought to light by Grenfell was the way that the cladding and insulation products used on that building had been marketed and sold and specified.
And certified.
That's true. Yeah. So there's a lot of clarification in that area, which I think is very, very timely and to be applauded. I mean, again, things which you'd think you might take for granted, like that, you know, the fact that they say that all construction products made available in the UK should fall under a regulatory regime, require all construction products to be safe. And also there's a proposal to compile a list of safety critical products, which I think is a little bit more complicated. But, you know, these are things, it's like motherhood and apple pie. You couldn't possibly object to these things. Of course, all construction products should be safe. And it's rather alarming to, you know, the inference is that there are some out there that aren't. I suppose the idea is that it depends largely on context, that, a brick that is not securely fixed into a wall and could fall off onto somebody's head is a product that isn't safe. But
it's not about, no, the brick isn't, it's not the brick that's not safe.
No, it's not the brick, it's the way it's installed. That's what I mean by context.
Which, to be honest, is what happened at Grenfell. I mean, the individual products were not inherently themselves dangerous. It was just the way that they were put together and the application that they were put to.
The explanation, the explanatory notes actually give a couple of hypothetical examples of what they mean about this, which do conjure up particular cases. Do you remember the brickwork on Scottish schools,
yes,
which collapsed a few years ago? They give a hypothetical example of a manufacturer launching a new kind of brick tie onto the market, saying that it's not subject to a designated standard or to a technical assessment and has not been added to the safety critical list, but could be added. After a few months in use, when installed correctly, the brick ties begin to fail, bringing about the risk that walls incorporating these ties will collapse, injuring passers-by. The proposed regulations will require the manufacturer to ensure their products can be used safely by identifying the risks associated with the use of the product and doing what can be done to mitigate this risk, including etc., etc., etc. Pretty obvious, really, but clearly this was not the case in these Scottish schools where the, I think it was the brick ties actually failed and the brickwork collapsed. So yeah, it's a brick tie is a safety critical product, I suppose. If it's not installed correctly, then it's a safety then it could be dangerous. And if it's not designed correctly, it could be dangerous.
I don't yet understand this. I mean, the bill creates the concept of a safety critical product, and it gives the Secretary of State the power to make regulations to place safety critical products on a statutory list.
Yeah.
But how do you decide what is a safety critical product? I mean, you mentioned a brick tie, but
yeah.
I mean, everything is safety critical, it seems to me, in a building.
Well, I immediately thought
in a certain application.
Yeah, I immediately thought supposing you had a concrete roof tile, and they're everywhere, concrete roof tiles. Supposing one broke, just, you know, freeze thaw or something like that, just cracked it, and it slid off a roof and landed on somebody's head. That'd probably kill them. In which case, the tile surely is a safety critical product. But was it a safety critical product when it was installed on the roof? Would it have been deemed to be one then? I don't know. I agree with you. I think that this is a little bit more nuanced, and maybe some clarification is needed here. I don't fully understand that.
Well, let's just go through the various parts of the bill. Part one. There are six parts in all. Part one is basically preamble, provides an overview of the bill, explaining how it makes changes to various existing legislation, most notably the Building Act 1984. Part two is all about the Building Safety Regulator and its functions. Part three amends the Building Act 1984 is all about building control authorities and building inspectors. Mm. Part four is concerned with higher risk residential buildings, in other words, tall, over 80 metre high residential buildings, when they're occupied. It defines the scope of the regime for higher risk buildings in occupation. And this is what I was talking about. It creates an accountable person. An accountable person and a building safety manager. This is when a building is completed and occupied, the accountable person is the duty holder to make sure the building remains safe, and they are required to appoint a building safety manager. An exception to this is where an accountable person has the organisational capability to deliver the role in-house. In other words, they can do it themselves. All this we've known about, this has been part of the consultation for ages, and it's all part of Hackett's review, Dame Judith Hackett's review, which we've read a lot about. Part five is all about the leaseholder's redress, looking backwards, but also looking forwards, the new homes ombudsman scheme being established, which we've talked about. It also, we haven't mentioned yet, it amends the Architects Act 1997 to allow disciplinary orders to be made against architects by the Professional Conduct Committee of the Architects Registration Board. And that's all quite interesting. The Architects Registration Board, is it VEBA or the Architects Registration Board? I think they're related bodies. Will have more, basically, the ongoing, continuing professional development of architects is being ramped up and controlled. And Architects Registration Board will be able to charge for its services or more of its services in terms of the CPD of architects.
Mm-hmm.
Part six is the boring stuff. Technical clauses relating to the bill, including Crown application and provision for liability of officers. No, me neither. But the point is, you've got the biggies here are Building Safety Regulator, New Homes Ombudsman, and the leaseholder.
Yeah.
Leaseholder redress, consumer rights, if you like.
Incidentally, We're just talking about bits of this we don't understand. And I mentioned the fact that the emphasis throughout this seems to be on higher risk residential buildings. But that new homes ombudsman...
That's for everything.
That's for everything. So if you've got a dodgy terraced house or something like that, then you know it's not a higher risk building, but you're still covered by that.
Yeah, it's developers or house builders selling you cheap rubbish, basically.
Yeah. Or expensive rubbish, as it tends to
be
these days.
But cheaply built is what I meant to say.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Shall I run through some of the comments that we've received from various people?
Yes, that's a good idea.
That might be worth. A couple of people with reservations. The president of the Royal Institute of British Architects, Alan Jones, said that we look forward to working with the new building safety regulator and the health and safety executive to implement effective changes. But we remain concerned that the proposed system does not fully address the fractured nature of current construction, procurement and contractual arrangements, which lack continuity of expertise. The continuity thing is addressed in the bill about this concept of a golden thread that's going to be created for all the data of the building and and everything's going to be on a computerized register and whatever, so that you rather like when you buy a car, you can have a logbook and Haynes manual, a logbook and a handbook and instructions. A building will have this as well. But so going back to what Alan Jones, the EU president, is saying, architects' knowledge and skills are crucial to driving up the best standards in the built environment, and we will continue to work closely with the Architects Registration Board to improve architectural education and professional development. Yada, yada, yada. But here we go. The practical details of the bill need urgent attention and in direct consultation with architects and other experts within the sector as we unite through a shared ambition to instill confidence and protect public safety. In other words, he says, the practical details of the bill need work. We've still got a fragmented industry, and that creates problems, and the bill doesn't address the problems of industry fragmentation. For which I think architects might read is that they used to have the architect, or in civil engineering projects, the engineer with the capital E, the old-fashioned resident engineer, or the clerk of works. There was someone who was, represented the client and was the boss and could say, no, that won't do, Gov. You know, that's not happening, not on my way. Now it's all design and build. Contractor is able to do what they want because it's the cheapest way to do it effectively. And that's the way the industry's moved. And there are all sorts of good, efficient reasons why it's gone in favour of design and build. But we have thrown the baby out with the bathwater and getting rid of the clerk of works. And I think that's the sort of issue that that Reba are alluding to here.
Yeah. Because it always used to be the architect that signed the project off, wasn't it? And I suppose they don't really want that power taken away from them. I don't suppose it's really a power grab, but they don't want their role to be watered down.
The architect is now just a hired hand. It's not the authority that it used to be. The same with the building control function that you're talking about. You can pick your own, pay your money, and you've got the answer you want.
Yeah.
Most of the comments we've received from construction industry vested interests have focused on how the construction industry is looks forward to the challenge and renewed sense of vigor, and we're going to work together and make this work kind of thing. But kudos to Peter Hogg of Arcadis for raising the other side of the coin. He says, looking at the plight of leaseholders in buildings that are blighted by historic issues, the bill does not see the government stepping in, and nor does it see them mandating developers and contractors to pick up the tab. The requirement for developers only to demonstrate that they have looked at alternatives before passing costs to leaseholders is not the answer that many leaseholders were desperately hoping for. It is an answer that will leave many in a state of continued uncertainty. In other words, Peter Hogg of Arcadis says leaseholders are being shafted, and not many people from the construction side have recognised that and flagged that up, it seems to me.
Is that a widespread view, do you think? Are there any other examples of people agreeing with that?
Oh, lots of people on the campaigning side have been saying it. As far as construction industry is concerned, I think their attention's diverted from that. I mean, those involved, I mean, maybe developers with liabilities on their books might be looking at that, but... most of the sort of people we talk to are people who design and build buildings, and their eye is on the next job, you know, the future jobs, on the work in hand. What do we now have to do? And frankly, leaseholders are not
a priority.
It's not not a priority. They're not even part of their universe.
Yeah, I see what you mean. So what happens now with this bill then? It's presumably getting another reading in Parliament, is it?
It has its first reading, then it'll be the second reading, then it'll go through the committee stages, which is where the real work gets done. There'll be a couple of dozen, maybe something like 15 to 25 normally, on the bill committee of MPs of all parties will really go through it clause by clause. And this is where all the lobby groups... My first job after university, I left university with a degree in politics. Didn't really know anything about politics, but got myself a job as a, these days it'd be called an intern. In those days, called a research assistant. Not that I did much researching. It was mostly making coffee and operating the photocopier and answering the phones. But it was interesting and fun. And the MP I was working for at the time was on the, this is 1987, and he was on the committee scrutinising Kenneth Baker's education reform bill.
Oh, yeah.
Known at the time colloquially as Gerbil, Great Education Reform Bill, the Gerbil, which is a bill that introduced the national curriculum. As you can imagine, there was a huge amount of lobbying from the classicists wanted Latin to be on the national curriculum. The sports interests wanted PE to be on the national curriculum, music people, everyone wanted everything to be on that, and it defeated the whole concept of a national curriculum. If you have absolutely every subject on the sun on the national curriculum, you don't have a core curriculum.
No.
So that was quite funny watching, eye-opening, watching how the lobbying world mobilised, and because the chap I was working for had been a university lecturer, he was particularly seen as a conduit to putting forward the interests of these vested interests. It was actually, I think it was Michael Fallon who was then on the committee as well, who promoted the classicists course. He was saying Latin should be, everyone should have to learn Latin at
a
school.
Core subject. Yeah.
Whereas my chap, I think, was more for the sciences. Yeah, the three R's, but adding sciences onto the three R's, if I remember rightly. Anyway, but I think that the lobbying will go on through the passage of this bill will be, I think, even more lively. On the one hand, the wretched leaseholders who are still suffering and are still not being well served by our politicians, who are stuck in buildings that they can't sell, or flats that they can't sell, I should say. And the various vested interests of the building industry will be, I'm sure, front and centre, trying to get details of clauses that they would like spun a different way,
shifted. Do you want to predict any potential changes that might be made to the bill? Do you think there'll be any pressure to water down any parts of it or bolster any other parts of it? What do you think of the vulnerable parts of this bill?
I think the 18-metre bit seems a bit arbitrary. I think there's scope for that to come down, but I don't know that anyone is particularly arguing for that.
Some people have already been talking about 11 metres, haven't they?
Yes, we've talked about this before. I can't remember. There's something to do with the government was going to foot the bill for... Its cladding fund is available for... remediation fund is available for buildings over 18 metres, I have for this from memory. And if you're between 11 and 18 metres, you can get a partial grant or a loan or free something or other. It's sort of a halfway house. Yeah, I think the definition of high-risk building is up for grabs, I think, because if it's a lower height building but has different types of people in there, perhaps older people or...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, less mobile people. Yeah.
Less mobile people, may become a different aspect there. Although I can't remember whether that's been covered in the fire safety bill. Some of those aspects might have been covered in the fire safety bill, which is a related but different piece of legislation. So I might be off topic there.
Okay. So, Royal Ascent, when's that likely to happen? Next year, presumably. Certainly not this year.
Well, we've got summer coming up, haven't we? The summer break. Yeah, no way it can be this year. It's got to be next year, hasn't it? Mm. I imagine ministers will have said some, or the guidance would have said somewhere when they might expect passage to be. But I think it'll be, yeah, it's got to be next year, I'm sure by now. Apart from reading the Building Safety Act, you've been putting a magazine together, haven't you? What have you got in this month's issue?
Well, we've got the July issue, yeah, is out end of last week, I think. Yeah, end of last week.
I've got mine, and I spilled beer all over it when England scored their third goal the other night. But I can still just about read it. Dear.
Well, yeah, yes, out. We've got some interesting features in there, as per usual. I don't know if any particularly caught your eye, Phil. There are one or two I found particularly interesting, and I wrote one of them. But there's an interesting project story in here, written by our contributor Paul Thompson, an old Construction News colleague of mine, who lives in Bristol, and he went along to his local concert hall.
Colston Hall. Oh, no, we're not allowed to call it that.
Not anymore. No.
Sorry.
It's now. You know, you might remember that a certain statue got thrown into the dock last year.
That was Mr. Colston.
It was indeed.
Edmund? What's his name?
Edward Colston.
Edward Colston, yes.
A sort of 18th century businessman, and you can't really
he's
call
been
him
cancelled.
Yeah, he has been cancelled. Yeah, he's been thrown
thing
into
is,
the
dock. Thing is, though, he's been cancelled for connection to slavery, but. Wasn't he a tobacco baron? Yeah, you'd thought he'd been cancelled long before the
well, I'm sure
colonial
condemned
aspect.
For all sorts of things. He was probably a thoroughly unpleasant man. Although, for a couple of centuries at least, he was lauded as the greatest benefactor the city's ever had. I mean, as Paul writes in his article, during his lifetime, he was admired as a wealthy merchant and he was a Tory member of Parliament and a philanthropist. And he said the City Fathers rewarded him by naming pretty much anything and everything after him. And, of course, Colston Hall, which was built, actually, I think, over 100 years after he died, was duly dedicated to him. Colston Hall, famous venue. I mean, it's had all the big rock bands, the Who, the Beatles, the Stones, Jimi Hendrix, Bob Dylan. They've all
performed Texas there about 5 years ago, I think. Or was it the Waterboys? I was there a few years ago.
Oh, right. Well, good there venue. We are, you see. Yeah, okay. Well, and a lot of classical musicians. I mean, some big ones. Rachmaninoff and Arthur Rubinstein performed there, and several of the big English orchestras. Anyway, yeah, so you can't call it Colston Hall anymore. It's now called the Bristol Beacon, and it's in the throes of a huge refurbishment project, which is being done by Wilmot Dixon. They did the first stage, the first phase of it, where they completed, I think, in about 10 years ago, 2009, where they built a new copper clad sort of foyer. You can't really call it a foyer, it's much bigger than that, an extension, I suppose, to the front of it. Very impressive looking modern structure. And they're now doing the second phase, which is far more complicated because this isn't new build, this is all restoration. And the Bristol Beacon is a very complicated sort of mixture of buildings, you know, it's been added onto over the years, and it's got three venues altogether, two main halls, Hall 1 and Hall 2. The idea is that it's being refurbished and brought up to standards. They're aiming to get absolutely world-class acoustic performance in here. So the idea is that you could have concerts taking place simultaneously in all three of the venues within the complex, and they won't interfere with each other. So there's some very complicated acoustic engineering and structural engineering going on. A lot of new steelwork going in. It's fascinating, actually.
Have you name-checked the people who are doing it?
Yeah, Wilmot Dixon.
You mentioned
Wilmot Dixon.
Wilmot
Dixon is the main contractor. The project itself, I mean, this gives you an idea of how complicated it is. I mean, it's not just complicated from a technical point of view, but from a logistical point of view and there are contractual issues, and of course there was COVID. I think the original project value was about 53 million. It's now spiraled up to nearly 107 million. So it's more than doubled. Yeah.
Is that because the job has changed, or because they found things they didn't know?
Partly because what they've uncovered. I mean, there are huge technical challenges. You know, they've stripped back the main hall into. There's Hall 1, Hall 2, and the Lantern Foyer. The Lantern Foyer and Hall 2 are both Grade 2 listed, so they've got to be very careful about what they do and how much reconstruction they do there. Hall 1, though, isn't listed, and that's been stripped right back to the original brickwork. But there's brickwork, stonework, rubble, all sorts of materials, all sort of mixed in together. And so they've found it's far more complicated and challenging than was originally thought. There are other things, like in Hall 2, for example, they've got these old brick pillars supporting the roof. Obviously, they need to keep those because it's listed. But they found out, they thought they were solid brick pillars, and then they found out they were hollow and weren't capable of taking the loads that were planned for them. So they then had to fill them with concrete. They had to pour concrete into them. But they had to do it very carefully. I thought it was quite funny, actually, because if they'd just poured concrete into each of these pillars from, you know, filling them up to the top, the pressure of the liquid concrete inside the pillars would have caused it to burst. Yeah. So I thought maybe they could have put some formwork around the brick pillars to hold them and, you know, keep them nice and firm. But they didn't do that. What they did instead was simply pour the concrete in stages, you know, a metre or so at a time, and let it go off a bit so that it was self-supporting, and then they pour the next bit in, and they did it like that. And yeah, when's it due to finish? I think next year sometime. I can't remember. I should know this.
No, you've got it on the, hang on, if I turn to the page, you've got it at the front. October 23. So it's still a while to go.
Yeah, still a while to go. But if you look at the pictures in the magazine, you can see how, you know, it gives you an idea of the scale of the task they've got there.
But these sort of things, it's not like a sports stadium where once you build it, you just got to sort of tie some plastic seats down. Inside a concert hall like this, it'll be beautifully fitted out, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
So even when the core building work is done, all the finishings, I think, will probably take a while, won't they?
Oh, yeah. I think it's going to be a really beautiful building when it's all done. And as I said, all the lovely architectural details will be preserved. But the actual performance of the spaces will be absolutely, you know, up to the minute. They're doing something else which I thought was a very interesting and impressive feat, was that they're building a new sort of plant room. You can't really call it a plant room. I think it's about 5 stories high. It's a steel sort of back of house area. It's got the goods lift and all the scenery machinery in there. It's got all the M&E, it's got the heating, the ventilation plant. Everything like that is being housed in a new steel structure, which is being constructed just 50 millimetres away from the neighbouring structures and completely isolated so that they can make as much noise they like there, and you won't be able to hear it in the auditoriums. There'll be no vibration transferred, that kind of thing. It's been complicated also by the fact that the bedrock in places is only 200 millimetres below the ground level. So they've had to actually chisel away solid rock, and they've had to insulate the building so that the vibration isn't transferred through the ground into the neighbouring structures. Obviously, you get your surveyors in to have a look at the project before you even start. But with a job like this, there's always going to be some surprises. And in this one, there's been a whole host of them by the sounds of things. And so, yeah, the price has skyrocketed. So it's going to be a far more expensive job than they thought originally.
But on the plus
side, it might be worth it.
On the plus side, it may in the end actually not be more expensive in the grand scheme of things than it was originally anticipated to be. Because if you think about it, while the COVID pandemic has made construction difficult and slowed some projects, it hasn't slowed construction in the same way that it's closed the events and concerts business. So over the past 18 months, there wouldn't have been much activity inside the Bristol Beacon, as it now is, anyway.
No, that's right.
So the Bristol Beacon as a venue would have lost millions, probably, over the past 18 months.
Yeah.
Maybe, I've no idea, it wouldn't have lost 50 million, I'm sure, but it would have lost a shed load as a venue. But it hasn't been open anyway. So the timing has been really fortuitous in that respect.
Well, and in fact, that is a point which is made in the article, because I talked about this, the bedrock. It's not just different parts of the building. There are also, you know, it's in the city centre. There are offices and other buildings around. And hammering through solid rock to excavate it right next door to buildings and other places of work, offices and so forth, would have been potentially very, very disruptive. But they've been able to crack on and do this without really worrying about disturbing people, because they've all been working from home. So it's actually had an unexpected benefit in that respect. Yeah, so I think you're right. And of course, you know, when things do get back together and back to normal, and these venues can open again and operate normally, well, I think people will be flocking to this venue in particular, if only to see, you know, how it's been transformed. So yeah, that I would urge people to read that feature. It's very interesting, and it's not the only one. Obviously, in the magazine, we've got others. We talked about the devastation being wrought to the historic rail estate last week, didn't we? About
it's more of a threat, I think. Isn't it? I mean, some bridges have been.
Yeah.
Certainly, the one, and you've got it in the magazine as well. I know it's the same.
Yeah.
The same one I put online last week. The picture of that one in Cumbria is pretty hideous.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
But
anyway, we've got a piece about that in the magazine as well. There's another interesting project here which we haven't spoken about. Again, technically very very complicated and quite interesting. It's Hammersmith Bridge.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, Hammersmith Bridge. Well, I haven't been up to London for God knows how long, so I hadn't realised that Hammersmith Bridge has been closed to traffic for quite a while now, a couple of years, I think. It's an old bridge designed by Bazalgette. Well, I can't remember his first name.
Joseph. Is it Joseph?
Yeah.
The family of them. So. Joseph was the embankment man.
Yes, it was. Sir Joseph Bazalgette. Famous engineer. Beautiful bridge. A lot of people will be familiar with it. Very ornate. But actually, it's been falling to pieces for years. And there's a lot of cast iron involved. And there are these ornate enclosures over the bridge piers and the... I can't remember the technical terms.
Well, it shut to traffic. They had to shut it to traffic about 2 years ago now.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they did. Yes, yes. In 2019, they closed it to traffic. I'm not even sure if river traffic can go underneath it at the moment. But it is. I mean, it is... in a pretty poor state. And the thing is that a lot of it is encased. A lot of the structural bits are encased in these ornate cast iron mouldings. And nobody's been inside to have a look at how it's getting on for over 100 years. So you take these decorative castings off and you see these pedestals and saddles and their roller bearings. And the roller bearings are all seized and the pedestals and the saddles are cracked. And so there's a huge problem here, and it's a massive cost. I can't remember what the cost is. It's Hammersmith and Fulham Council own it now. It transferred to the ownership of the council after the abolition of the GLC quite a long time ago. But they really haven't got the dosh to do a full job on it yet. I can't remember how much the estimated cost is going to be. It's in the article here somewhere, and I'm desperately trying to find it. But the DFT have bunged them 2.3 million, which sort of will keep it standing for a little while. But the thing is that it's quite an important thoroughfare. And of course, having been closed, that's caused an awful lot of disruption. And this is one of the interesting things, that the architect Foster and Partners have teamed up with Cowie, the engineer. Is it pronounced Cowie or Coe, the engineers?
I pronounce it Cowie, but I've not.
Yeah, I do. But anyway, they've come up with an ingenious solution to reopen the bridge, but not actually the bridge, to reopen the route by putting a temporary structure, a temporary crossing within, on the footprint of the bridge and above the bridge deck. And so basically it would be a bridge within a bridge. It'd be self-supporting. It wouldn't impinge upon the original
structure. For vehicles or just for pedestrians, David?
For vehicles and pedestrians. It's going to be a double, a two-deck temporary bridge with pedestrians underneath and vehicles going over the top. And it will be, it will follow the footprint of the original bridge, but it will allow the original deck to be completely removed from underneath it. So it's a I can't remember what it's called. It's a truss, some kind of truss structure. Quite a complicated engineering feat because, of course, it's got to be quite long and thin, and yet it can't derive any support from the bridge itself. So it is. It is very ambitious. It hasn't been agreed yet, I don't think, and they certainly haven't started installing it. It's still a proposal.
I must confess, I haven't read the whole magazine yet. I've only looked at the pictures of this particular article, and it's not clear. I have to read the details. It's not clear how such a long, I don't know what the span of Hammersmith Bridge is, but it's not small. But what looks essentially like a sort of a Bailey Bridge type of structure, but two deck. If it's not taking its weight from the existing bridge, how it supports itself. So it's obviously some cunning engineering going on here.
It is a clear span, essentially, all the way across.
Within the existing bridge sort of thing, but not touching it, but not taking...
Not touching it, exactly, exactly. So, that's an interesting one.
I tell you what, though, they call it a temporary solution. I wonder how temporary it will be, because when as soon as that's in there and the traffic's running again, everyone involved in the decision-making go...
The pressure will be off.
Don't have to worry about that. It'll be some other bugger's problem in 5-10 years' time. So and everyone will just push it, you know, kick the can down the street again for the next however long.
It might be. It might just be the new. Well, they've got to do something to the original bridge because if it is in such a bad condition that if they don't do something about it, it will fall into the Thames. Yeah, I know what you mean. These temporary solutions often end up being semi-permanent, but I think that they can't afford to just soft pedal now. They've got to crack on and repair the original bridge, because if they don't, there'll be a catastrophic failure and fairly soon.
I thought the boat race was in wherever it was this year, but not in London, was because of COVID. But I'm now thinking, was it because of Hammersmith Bridge? They weren't allowed to go over Hammersmith Bridge.
Well, that isn't mentioned in the article, but that's a good point. Yes, it wasn't it held on the Eton Boating Lake or something, the boat race? I might be wrong.
But the point is, an awful lot of important people who think quite a lot of the boat race and would be pushing for it to come back to the Thames, I'm sure.
Yes, it would have been embarrassing for the bridge to come down in the middle of the boat race.
Now, there's one other story which I posted this week, which I thought was worth a brief mention. And this is a press release that got sent by precast specialist JP Concrete. Precast specialist JP Concrete has signed a deal with a Dutch company called Basilisk to use their self-healing concrete, it's called, in its precast products. Now, this concrete uses apparently limestone-producing bacteria that when the bacteria comes into contact with oxygen and water, they convert some of the nutrients to limestone, calcium carbonate.
And so as soon as you get a crack...
So as soon as you get a crack, water gets in, air gets in, and there's a chemical reaction takes place.
Or biological reaction.
And limestone calcium carbonate is formed. And I thought, well, this sounds fun. I suppose you might not even know how well it's working. So half the time, if it happens, you might not even know it's happened. So it could be a placebo effect for all we know. I don't know. But... If either way you don't get problems, then it's obviously a product worth investing in.
I'll tell you the thing which I liked about this article was the name of the microbiologist who founded Basilisk. He's got a fantastic name. He's called Henk Jonkers.
Well, it's Dutch. Is it Jonkers or Jonkers? I don't know how you pronounce Dutch.
I don't know. Henk, but it's a name to conjure with. Probably sorry, Jonkers. I'm being Jonkers. Facetious. That's not the most interesting part of the story. Yeah, I thought this was interesting. But we've done stuff about self-healing concrete before, haven't we?
Yes, it rang a bell with me. I mean, JP Concrete was saying that they're introducing self-healing concrete to the UK market, and they're the first people. And it may be they are to offer it commercially, but there have been trials before, haven't there? I mean, you yeah, did something yeah. in the magazine a couple of years ago.
I'd completely forgotten about it until you reminded me. And it was about, I think, a civil engineer at Nottingham University who was inspired by, of all things, snail caviar to develop a method of creating self-healing asphalt. It wasn't actually concrete, it was asphalt.
Hold on. Snail caviar.
Snail caviar. Snail caviar, apparently,
I know
is all
fish
the rage
caviar.
With,
yeah. Well, I've had it very often. But I didn't know snails produce caviar as well.
Well, you might have even seen it because you're a keen gardener, Phil. And if you've forked over your garden in the past and found a little cluster of white beads, that's snail caviar, basically. And it's a delicacy beloved of the hipster fraternity. It is basically just snail eggs. Anyway, but it's, if anybody knows what caviar is, and I'm sure most people do, even if they haven't tried it themselves, fish eggs or snail eggs, little round balls with juicy stuff inside them. This civil engineer at... I'm talking about the wrong story now. We should be talking about basilisk. But very quickly, yeah, the caviar one was he created these little beads containing some sort of oil. And you mix it in your asphalt mix. And then when the asphalt ages and it gets dry and brittle and starts to crack, these little beads fracture and the oil bleeds out, acts as a solvent, dissolves the bitumen that it comes into contact with, which then flows into the crack and seals it. So that's your self-healing asphalt.
For asphalt, yeah. Sorry, I was thinking it was a rival product, but this is for asphalt rather than for concrete.
Yeah. But similar sort of idea, absolutely. And the other one you were talking about was on Costain's Heads of the Valleys project, wasn't it?
Yes, that was in Wales. Yeah. Back in 2015, a doctoral student, civil engineer there, it was a civil engineer, but also doing a PhD, they built a retaining wall or some concrete structure.
Yeah.
They trialed several different self-healing concrete techniques or methods on this one structure to see what worked. And there's a bit on this actually also on the Costain website. If you Google Costain self-healing concrete research, it tells you all about this guy, Oliver Teal. This is posted in 2016. I assume he's got his PhD by now, although these things can take a long time. Yeah. I'm sure he's got it by now. What I don't know is that whether the research at Heads of the Valley has yielded any results yet, because obviously concrete takes a long time to spall or to go rusty or rotten or whatever. So whether any of the, you know, whether anything's happened that has needed it to self-heal or not, I don't know. So I did email Costain that in anticipation of our conversation today, yesterday, but they're on the case. They're hunting it out for us.
Oh, right. Okay.
Any lessons from that to any conclusions to draw. But again, I don't think he was using any commercially available products. So it's JP Concrete who appear to be the first offering it to the market on a commercial basis.
The one thing that did cross my mind when I was reading this was obviously when you've got a crack appearing in some concrete, the problem is, essentially, not so much the crack, but the fact that it lets the water in and the rebar starts to corrode, and then you've got spalling, and you know that's the thin end of the wedge. It just gets worse and worse and worse. I just wondered how quickly do these bacteria mobilize, because they're basically asleep until they are exposed to oxygen and water. So you get your crack, the water gets in, the bacteria start working. Do they work faster than the corrosion on the rebar, or do they seal up the crack before it even gets to the rebar? And even if they don't, if the rebar has already started to corrode, will it stop? Will they arrest the corrosion once they have sealed the crack? Those are the sorts of questions that I'd like to have answered, because I mean it's very clever. In fact, it's almost sort of
witchcraft.
Yes, it is. I mean, bacteria that create limestone to seal cracks. I mean, it's astonishing. No, I'd just like to know how timescales and how effective it actually is, and whether or not it's a race against the rust.
Well, to a certain extent, you have to trust the. Oh, we're back on the Grenfell thing again, aren't we? You have to trust the experts, because you don't want to start carving it open to see if it's worked, because then if it's worked, you've wasted your time.
And if
it's not worth, you wasted your time, I suppose, by putting it there in the first place.
But they're bound to have non-destructive techniques these days that can, inspect the rebar for corrosion. I bet they could do that. Yeah. So no, I that's the sort of story I like. It's really off the wall. You wouldn't expect bacteria to be the solution to concrete destruction, really.
Right, David, we have been talking for even longer than we did last week, I think, now.
I know.
So shall I start wrapping this up?
Yeah, go on.
Thanking everyone to listening to us. And I'm going to continue talking to just until and no later than that music starts. So I can see the music coming down the street towards me, so I better speed up and say thank you, everyone, for listening. But for another week, this has been me, Phil Bishop, and him, David Taylor, saying thank you very much and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.